Bill Resnick and Max Elbaum commented on the quit wave that is affecting America and Striketober. And that brings us to the other aspect of left power that we need to rebuild. And that is power that exists in the fact that the majority of us are working class and the majority of us are making things happen. And if we aren't showing up or aren't making things happen, then the bosses and the owning classes all have something to worry about. And that is why I brought Eric Dernbach on the show to talk about an article he wrote for Organizing Work called Millions of Workers Are Quitting, They Should Be Organizing. Thanks for coming on The Old Mole, Eric Dernbach.
Great to be here, Joe. Thank you.
So you wrote an article for the publication Organizing Work, which we've talked about on The Old Mole before, about how millions of workers are quitting their jobs and they should be organizing. Just before we jump into our conversation about the Great Resignation and the quit waves, could you just say a bit about your involvement with the labor movement and what you're doing with it today?
Yes, my name is Eric Dernbach, he, him pronouns, based in New York City. And I have been a union researcher and campaigner and organizer for a few different unions for the last 20 years. Kind of got my start in the labor movement in the 1990s when I was a grad student at University of Michigan, and I was heavily involved with the Teaching Assistants Union, or the Graduate Student Instructors Union, as we called it, for about 5 years, including being president of the local when we went on strike and bargained what I think was the best contract in our union's history. And I really took a lot of lessons about kind of real democratic, militant rank and file unionism from that, and try to hold on to that over the years. And I'm also a member of the IWW and DSA, and just supportive of workers organizing in a lot of different ways and formats. And, you know, because I'm a labor nerd also, I tend to like to look at a lot of labor data, whether it's strikes and elections. We'll talk about some of that today, just to kind of figure out what's going on with workers these days and how we can help folks organize.
So the Great Resignation is what some people are calling this phenomenon of workers both quitting and being hard to rehire across the American economy. Could you say a bit about what the data says?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we recognize that the pandemic has thrown the labor workforce into a lot of turmoil over the last year and a half at this point. At the beginning of the pandemic, you know, unemployment went up to 15%. As a lot of folks were laid off, and like huge sections of the economy basically had to shut down in order to control the pandemic. And now, you know, unemployment has been creeping back down. Now it's about 5% as folks have been returning to the workforce. But I think we're seeing something really interesting this year, which you're right, they're calling the Great Resignation, which is that record numbers of millions of workers have been quitting their jobs. There's a lot of articles about, you know, what they're calling the Great Resignation, and, you know, a lot of anecdotes. And usually these articles are interviews with employers about how they have a hard time finding workers. And, oh no, they've had to raise wages, et cetera. Sometimes there's interviews with workers too. And I took a look at the data, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics has a monthly survey which looks at job openings and quits and layoffs. And, you know, it turns out it's this last, I think basically this whole year, we've seen several months that had record-setting quits. Just in August, 4.3 million workers quit their jobs. That was 2.9% of the workforce. And this year, all the months this year up to August, 30 million workers have quit. And it's just a level of quits that just hasn't been seen, I think, since they've been keeping records. And along with that, I think you've noticed too, Joe, it's like a lot of you know, videos and photos online of workers posting signs saying, you know, we've had it and we quit, or the store is closed, or things like that. Oftentimes, you know, I think left Twitter and labor Twitter kind of loves to see that because we're kind of sticking it to the boss. So that's anecdotes, but I think the data is backing that up, that there are a lot of folks just kind of had it, fed up with work and quitting. We can talk about the ramifications for that, but there does seem to be this thing happening this year. Yeah.
There's a lot of quitting going on, but especially in the first 6 months of the pandemic and on and off since, there have been massive layoffs too, not to mention the 700, or at least in the first year, 500,000 Americans who died of COVID alone. And then the millions of people who had to go back home to take care of their children. There's a lot of other factors that create this gap that aren't being talked about as much. Why do you think that's the case?
We recognize that this last year and a half has been such a weird and unique situation that I think a lot of folks are still grappling with what the hell has happened here. I mean, certainly lots of layoffs early in the pandemic. And, you know, there was, to some extent, support workers that could not go to their jobs because these jobs had to shut down. And then, you know, there was a whole bunch of workers that were able to work from home and kind of discover the benefits of being able to, in many cases, carry out their job on Zoom. I've been lucky enough to be able to work from home this entire time. And then there's a whole bunch of folks that were deemed essential workers that had to show up every day under potentially dangerous circumstances. And as you say, you know, we've had a tremendous death toll, over 700,000 from the pandemic. So many workplaces were not safe enough. Employers did not take it seriously enough. So, you know, the workforce was kind of divided up among essential workers that had to keep going to work, folks that got laid off, folks that were able to continue working from home. And I think, you know, some of the ramifications from all that turmoil are that we have millions of workers that are deciding in their own way that their jobs aren't good enough. They haven't been treated well enough. They're looking for more. And it's partly the reason why we're seeing all this quitting going on.
Some of the arguments that are coming from the especially conservative quarters of the media are blaming government benefits on this. And in some particularly disturbing moments, even suggesting in a very Malthusian mood that if we remove those benefits, then we'll be able to stir economic participation. Is that really holding water?
You're right. There was that one interview where somebody said the quiet part out loud, like we should starve workers like dogs and then they'll go back to work. I think the support that workers were able to get with pandemic assistance, from what I'm reading, it was a factor, not the major one. I think folks have looked at states that had more or less assistance to see if there were major differences in who was working and who wasn't. And there really wasn't that big a difference. First of all, I would say if workers got assistance that allowed them to avoid terrible jobs, then that's great. And we should get more of that. Conservatives hate it, but we want workers to be able to sit out and be picky about jobs and avoid terrible jobs. So to the extent that happened, good, but that's only one factor. There was also childcare issues were hard to arrange. Kids have been in and out of school. A lot of folks are still worried about working in especially customer-facing jobs like restaurants or retail, especially in places where customers are walking around potentially sick and maskless and being really rude to the workers. So working conditions in a lot of industries, particularly lower wage industries, are not good. And they haven't been good for a long time. And I think we have a case now where workers were potentially able to get some assistance. I think I've even seen some data that a lot of workers were able to even save up some money, you know, because I think people like went out less, they spent less money. You know, of course, most of the money saving was done at the higher end of the income scale. But even members of the traditional working class maybe saved a little bit of money. And so they're able to be pickier about jobs. I think all of that is in the mix, which is all very interesting. And it's why 2021, you know, has contributed to more labor turmoil than we've seen in a long time. Now, on top of all that, and we can talk about this too, Striketober and all of the massive strikes that are going on with unions, a number of major ones going on, other ones being threatened. I think we're seeing more strike activity this year, certainly than last year. And it's also something that labor folks are keeping an eye on.
One of the strikes that is set to go on among Kaiser nurses and healthcare workers really goes to show that wage shortage is not really the whole story here. There are workers in higher paid industries or jobs that also are not wanting to work. There's like 40 to 50% of Kaiser nurses said that they're thinking of quitting, and nurses already make a good amount of money. So there's something else that's coming to a head in all of these quit waves and the problems with hiring workers. And I'm wondering, what are employers trying to do to turn this around? And do you think that they can really offer what workers want?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that wages have crept up, especially at the low end. You know, the Fight for 15 movement started in 2012. And I think at that point, less than half of all workers were making $15 an hour. So we actually hit a milestone in the last month. The average wage in grocery and restaurants, I think, finally went above 15. And 80% of all workers are now making at least 15 an hour. So, and I think part of what we're talking about has led to that. Employers hate to raise wages. We always say that if you have trouble finding workers, raise your wages. Maybe that's basic econ 101. They hate to do it, but they've had to do it. Wages are going up. It is an interesting question you ask about, like, is there anything else employers are doing to entice workers back? I'd love to hear more about that. All I'm really seeing are, you know, articles that come out about mostly employers complaining, as they always do, raising wages, offering bonuses, you know, free meals, other things to entice folks back. even I think like offering gift cards just to show up for interviews. There's all kinds of ways. It'll be interesting to see kind of how this settles out. And you know, I think once wages are raised, they're hard to reduce again. Wages tend to be sticky. So we certainly are seeing more worker leverage this year as a result of all these quits. And I think, you know, there have been comparisons to all of this as there's kind of an unofficial general strike going on. In other words, that workers are kind of voting with their feet by not wanting to work under these conditions. And I appreciate the sentiments. I think it's a little bit different because we're talking about millions of workers making the individual decision to quit, as they have the right to do, rather than more of a collective effort to strike. But the ramifications of all this quitting, I think, have moved the needle on job conditions in terms of wages are rising. And it'll be interesting to see if other working conditions improve.
You lay it out right there that there is this disconnect between organized collective power on the job to make these changes and then the aggregate effect of individuals making these choices and putting the pressure on management to change something or else they're not going to get workers. Your article focuses on why workers should not be leaning on this market power, but should be leaning on their own labor power, which is kind of being demonstrated in the whole quit wave in a disorganized way. What difference do you think it really makes that workers should understand that it makes to apply that power in an organized way and not just walk away from bad job conditions, but change them?
We understand and support if workers have to quit a terrible job. Absolutely. You know, what happens, like workers quit a job and then at some point they have to find another job. And hopefully that next job will be slightly better at slightly higher wages. But really, you know, as I say in the article, we have like kind of a massive round of musical chairs going on. And it would be better, you know, for the working class overall, if more workers decided to stay on the job and organize for improvements. You know, we could talk about like what that means, but I think we have to recognize that, you know, a lot of folks aren't thinking about that because the typical response when workers are unhappy at their job is to quit. And that's usually what people will suggest. If you don't like it, then you should just quit. Okay, fine. But there's been examples out there of like whole McDonald's or, you know, Dollar General's or IHOP's or other stores, like whole shifts of workers walking out. And so we have to wonder what would have happened if instead of 10 workers quitting, they decided to go on strike instead, or they drew up a petition and demanded changes from their boss. The employer would have a hard time replacing them. They probably, in some of these cases, could have won some concessions that would have improved the job. And so then the question is like, how can we, you know, we meaning kind of a labor movement as a whole, teach workers that organizing is an option? Because I think it doesn't occur to a lot of folks. It's not clear how folks can organize or what that looks like. Most people, I think, don't have a clear idea about what a union is or how to form one. There is some interesting data that a lot of folks kind of are interested in unions, which I can talk about. But I think this is the major question we have in this kind of turmoil that we're seeing where there's a lot of discontent. We need to get into workers' hands in a massive way the education and the ability to do organizing instead of just quitting. And I think that would be really interesting to do.
I know that you are doing work with the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, which has created a worker organizing kind of tutorial that's one size fits most for workers to then take back to their workplaces. And the traditional goals of like union organizing are to get a contract, to get legal recognition, and to move the needle on your wages and benefits. But what other ways can workers organize to change their work is like, if not also maybe their pay and other benefits, that doesn't necessarily have to go for that all or nothing kind of arrangement?
First of all, let's talk about what people think about unions. There's some surveys that come out. Gallup does an annual one, and they just came out with their recent data last month, which look at union approvals. They've been asking this question for 60, 70 years. Do people approve of unions? And they found a record 68% approval rating. They say it was their highest approval rating since the 1960s. So, you know, over two-thirds of people approve of the concept of unions. Okay, maybe we're not sure what that means. But another survey from a few years ago basically asked non-union workers, would you like to be in a union? And half of them said yes. You know, there's over 100 million private sector non-union workers in this country. It's a large country. If half of them want to be in a union, that's 50 million workers, 50. A lot of workers. Now, it's not clear to me if most of those folks really understand what it means to join a union or form a union. I think what folks want is they want the better wages, benefits, and working conditions. and a voice on the job and more protections from being arbitrarily fired. Like, they want all those things that they associate with a union job, and it is all true. But it's not clear to folks usually how to form a union or how to organize or what that would even mean. So the labor movement really is failing. It's a massive task, so I don't want to say it's easy. But the labor movement overall is really failing on finding a way to reach out to millions of workers to just on basic organizing education. It's just not easy for folks to just join a union. And you talked about the traditional way of organizing. The traditional way is workers at a workplace would sign authorization cards and file with the government for a union election. You would have your election. Hopefully you win. You probably have to withstand potentially months of union busting, which scares the workers and raises doubt. If you win, then the employer gets dragged to the bargaining table and you hammer out a contract, which can sometimes take over a year. It's a long drawn out process. Unions generally are pretty good at winning elections. And then in maybe half or more of the time they get a contract. So it is a process that I recommend that folks go through if they want to organize a union in the standard way. But it's not the only way to do it. And you're right. I've been volunteering with this thing called EWOC, the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. It's a joint project of DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, and the United Electrical Workers. And it was formed at the beginning of the pandemic to just provide education and assistance for workers that wanted to do any kind of organizing around COVID issues or anything else. So I mean, think that the secret that so few workers know is that any group of workers in the workplace that decide to get together and organize and demand improvements, they are acting like a union. They have the legal right to do that. It is not legal to fire them for doing that. It could happen because this is risky and employers will break the law. But that kind of organizing is totally valid. And simply by forming an organizing committee, drawing up a list of demands that a majority of workers feel deeply, bringing that to the boss and saying, we need these things. Oftentimes workers will win improvements just by doing that. And I consider that union organizing. It's not official. You don't get recognition. You don't bargain a contract. I think workers can do that eventually if they want to. This is often called solidarity unionism. This is the method of organizing that the industrial workers of the world has done for over 100 years. And it is often successful, but workers, I think, need to know about it. They need to be trained in it. And I think that is the challenge, is how do we spread this information to millions of workers?
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Last week, Eric Dernbach and I talked about the uptick in quit waves across America and the different factors that are giving workers leverage in the economy. And we're talking about how we need to be focusing that energy into organizing behind the leverage that that represents. In this second half, we really get down to the rubber meets the road reality of union power, worker power, control of labor. And it's so important, I think, for workers to realize how much power we have. Kim Moody's piece today that Patricia Kohlberg is talking about is all about how the economy is very fragile and depends on our labor working in concert much more than it ever did before. And where we left off, we were talking about kind of the solidarity union model and how to educate workers on how to take power in their workplaces amongst themselves, and was then turning to ask about the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee and how it has been trying to fill the gap of worker political education is just an example of the kind of educating that we need to be doing. What is EWOC doing to teach around these concepts and skills?
So the process is, I mean, there's a form on the website, you know, if a worker encounters, they hear about it or they know somebody who's in it or something like that, they fill out the form, then they have an intake conversation with a volunteer organizer to find out the basics. You know, where do you work? What's going on? What are the working conditions? What are the issues? And then it kind of goes into the database, and then a more advanced organizer will contact them for additional conversations. And I have been one of those organizers. And I joined the project because I was intrigued about this effort to just reach more workers that wanted help. And so I've taken, you know, I think at this point, 70 cases, you know, where I reach out to workers and we have conversations. Now, honestly, like half of them I never hear back from because workers change their mind or they quit or they don't want to do it. But I get into conversations with workers and we come up with an organizing plan. And EWOC on its website has kind of like the five steps of organizing basics. And these are very similar that you will find with IWW training or Labor Notes training, or Jane McAlevey's strike training, or other basic trainings. And that is start talking to coworkers and finding out what people's issues are, form an organizing committee. Ideally, it's something like 10% of the workforce. So if you work at a workplace with 100 workers, ideally your committee would have 10 workers. That committee continues to talk with folks. You map the workplace, you know, literally keep a spreadsheet. Who talks with whom? Who are workplace leaders? What are folks' issues? Boil down the list of issues to like 3 to 5 that folks care about the most and are willing to take action on. And then a typical action, it doesn't have to be this way, but a typical action is that you will get a majority of workers at the workplace to sign a petition to the boss. It could be friendly language, if you want, saying we need these things. List the things that you need. And then do a march on the boss, where you have a committee, bring it to the boss's office, give it to them, read it to them, and say we expect a reply. It could look a bunch of ways. Some folks like it more confrontational. Some folks, you know, want to have a friendly chat. But strength in numbers matters. Having a majority matters. You're more likely to win. There's less likely to be retaliation. Oftentimes, people will win. I think it's really interesting. EWOC now has hundreds of campaigns. A lot of them are still in progress. And, you know, I think we're collecting data on, you know, how many have started, how many have won something, what are the steps that they went through. And I suspect that, you know, if workers can form an organizing committee, draw up their demands and take some action, that they will win improvements. So then you take stock, see where you're at, and then organize for more. You know, so organizing kind of never ends. It's the ongoing class war. But that is valid union organizing. You don't have a written contract, but you have organized and you have won improvements. And the boss has ceded power and you have claimed some power. So that is the process and it's not without risk. So I would not recommend that folks embark on a strike tomorrow. This needs to be well thought out and planned. And that is the process at EWOC and I know also at IWW, where we will work with folks to form this plan over time, do this organizing, take the notes, come up with a strategy, and then take action when workers are ready.
This is so important to emphasize, I think, in this time when strikes are getting such a focus on the meaning of worker power, and of course they are, but there is a whole bunch of foundational skills and activity and aptitude that you build up by taking on problem solving in the workplace with your coworkers that, to begin with, doesn't look like a strike. It can be pretty friendly, and then once you don't get the response you want, then you learn how to escalate and find a more compelling way to present your issues or to force the boss to consider the only way to deal with you is to deal with your issues. But at the same time, strike power, that threat of not getting the work done, is really the backbone of union power. So I'm wondering what you think the quit wave and the recognition in the public consciousness that workers run the world and without them the bosses can't do anything, what this means for the existing unions in terms of turning back to not just strike power in terms of the all-out strike, but the control of labor, the control of your problems on the job as the baseline for labor militancy, which is not something that the labor peace goals of the National Labor Relations Act labor movement typically encourage. They, you know, encourage management rights and come to us when the contract's violated, but anything that falls short of that is, you know, what you have to deal with until we can bargain it away maybe later.
This is, in a sense, a kind of huge and complicated issue, but it can be simplified. I mean, first of all, you said the right word, which is escalation. And so any group of workers that are organizing, I would never suggest or urge that they go on strike tomorrow. It's slowly building your organizing and to build the trust and the capacity and the confidence to take actions, including escalating actions, which might eventually lead to a strike. And at that point, I would say also have supporters on the outside that can show up and help you on your picket line and set up a GoFundMe or some other strike fund. Like, there are pieces to put in place. And it does take some time and it's worth taking the time and it shouldn't be rushed. I mean, this is one reason I think you and I agree that calls for hashtag general strike are not really going to work, because that kind of trust building and capacity and confidence has not been built. Groups of coworkers need to work together over time to trust one another so that you don't just have one or two people walking out because they're probably going to get fired. You know, there's strength in numbers. So that, I think, is true. You mentioned about just, you know, regular union practice, you know, often kind of discourages this kind of activity. And on the one hand, yes. The way labor law has developed since the 1930s, the standard union practice usually has a union contract with a no-strike clause And, you know, workers have the ability to strike once the contract expires around bargaining time. It's not always that way. There are some exceptions, but that has been the general practice. There is a current of opinion, which I'm sympathetic to, which is that union contracts should not have no strike clauses. There is no reason to have them. It's a little bit complicated legally, but I would say, sure, it would be great if more unions would ditch the no strike clauses and then strike whenever there are problems at work that need to be settled. Again, it's a little complicated legally, unfortunately, but workers that don't have a union contract or any officially recognized union don't have those issues at all. They can go on strike whenever they are ready. Again, it is not without risk. It is not legal to be fired, but believe it or not, the boss can replace you with scabs, with replacement labor. In fact, they can permanently replace you. That is legal. So that's why we have to be careful about this. Now, some folks might say, what's the difference between being fired or permanently replaced? Well, not much, although there is a legal distinction. But I think the reason why we're talking about this as a possibility is that this year, when workers are quitting and bosses seem to be desperate for workers, there's more leverage on the worker side. Bosses will have a harder time finding scab replacements. So, you know, we would talk it through and we would see if specific groups of workers have the leverage that we think they might have, and then we can take action. But yeah, I know you raised a bunch of issues. And so I think that there's the regular kind of organizing that unions do, and then there's this kind of other kind of organizing. And I think any group of workers, I think we should start certainly with the solidarity unionism kind of organizing of just getting a committee and organizing. And then later on, they can make the decision if they want to go a more formal route.
With the question of the no strike clause and strikes, there is a lot of terrain that, or there's a lot of opportunities for worker power to be exercised that are obscured by that language, because there's so much that workers can do to control the labor process that don't involve walking out that also are typically excluded under these no strike clauses, including slowdowns and any other type of way of interfering with the production process, which are in those no strike clauses because bosses know that the all out strike is not the only way that workers can mess with them. And at the same time, there is this tremendous pressure on workers to keep up with sped up demands that they should be able to work within what is comfortable for them, effectively slowing down the production line as a just a self-preservation method, but then it's also a source of power for getting the boss to change things, especially when it comes to staffing levels and safety or health concerns that are directly tied to those.
Yeah, you're exactly right. We should not talk about the strike as the only thing workers can do. You know, oftentimes we look at strikes because they're big and dramatic, but there are other things that workers can do. Sometimes it might make sense for workers to stay on the job and do, as you say, there are things like slowdowns or work to rule. And, you know, work to rule are interesting because basically, you know, there is often a thick handbook of regulations and rules that workers have to officially have to follow. But then unofficially, they're asked to cut corners and speed things up. So a work to rule is, you know, workers collectively, ideally it's everybody or a majority, decide you're going to take your time and follow every rule. And then, of course, like things slow down and you're not as productive. And so there are those kinds of on-the-job tactics. And it may not even be clear to the boss, like, what exactly is going on. And if they kind of figure out and people seem like they're working slowly, then you can just say, look, I'm following the rule book. So you can see that there are other possibilities than walking out. And of course, if you stay on the job and organize in that way, you're getting paid and the risk is less. So I think there are all these kind of on-the-job tactics. Other examples are workers simply deciding to do a thing. So for instance, you know, it's been a big thing over the last year with Black Lives Matter about whether workers are able to wear like a BLM support pin, or, you know, in other cases, whether workers can wear pronoun pins. Oftentimes employers don't want workers to do this. So instead of workers signing a petition asking if they can do it, they can all decide they're going to put on pronoun pins. And then the employer, so they basically have done it. And then the employer has to decide, okay, do I want to make an issue about this? Seems like everyone's wearing pins now. And sometimes they'll let it go. They might ask about it, et cetera, et cetera. They might let it go because it's not worth fighting about. And then the workers have set a new standard on the job. Maybe it's small. Now they have pronoun pins and they didn't have them before, but they didn't ask. They just did it. So I think that there's many possibilities for things like that, where if like you can get 3/4 or more of the workers to do a thing, the employer might just give up on it and let it happen, right?
I'd like to end on that note, making the boss just accept our terms of working for them. I've been talking with Eric Dernbach, a labor activist and educator, member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and a organizer, educator with the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. Thanks so much, Eric, for coming on and, you know, talking through these things and helping us clarify, you know, what we need to be focusing on.
Yeah, it's been great, Joe. Thank you.
Well, before I go, I'd like to share a poem. Listen, worker, I'm the boss. If you don't make me money, then you're gonna get tossed. What I pay you is what you get, so take your mind off of all of my profit. Listen, tenant, we don't agree. This ain't your home, it's my property, and I will milk it for what it's worth and kick them out who can't keep up. Back off, landlord, don't bully me. Us tenants got solidarity. We got a union that'll go on strike for every new goddamn rent hike. Fellow workers, hear me sing about the power to change everything. Without labor, without rent, all the bosses are impotent. When the day comes and we see our special power in the economy, we will seize the great machine and finally live finally free.